Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. Dr. Kerry Enright of the Uniting Church, of Uniting World, actually, the Uniting Church's Agency for International Church Partnerships. He's recently accepted a position in New Zealand, from whence he came, and is leaving these shores quite shortly to go to Dunedin. Kerry Enright, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thanks very much, John.
Kerry Enright, the reason I've asked you in is it's not simply to get a feel for how things are with the church and your position, but you're an example of where the churches, particularly the Uniting Church, the Anglicans and the Catholics, have taken a very strong view that the church needs to be engaged in civil society. And Uniting World is the agency that you've had responsibility for the last 7 years. When you took that job, did you have some idea of where you felt the church needed to be placed and where you wanted to take such an agency?
Yeah, thanks very much, John. And it seemed to me that we were in an area of society which was so crucial to the health of our nation and the health of the church, and that was international relationships. So how could we be good global citizens? How could we respect those countries that we engaged with and yet also assist them? And the remarkable thing about the church is, of course, it's a global movement and it has quite intimate relationships with churches in other countries. We're all part of the same body. That's how we speak of ourselves. So how do we give flesh and bone to that? How do we make that tangible? How does it become more than simply a philosophy that we sign up to? And so for me, it was a matter of how do I help Australian people have a sense of being part of a global family? And for the church, it means also knowing the names of people in countries that we relate to and the churches that we relate to. The Uniting Church in Australia has 35 international partnerships. And I wanted people to know, for example, the name of the president of the Methodist Church in Fiji and to be able to have a sense of the context within which they were working, because it has to do with how do we live here in Australia? How does our living here impact on people who live in other places? You can't live in Australia without having a sense of the impact that it has on people who live in Tuvalu and Kiribati and Tokelau and parts of Papua New Guinea, which are susceptible to climate change, to the seawater rising. So there are two parts of it. One is the concern for our partners overseas, but the other is to do with the integrity of our living here, the shape of our lives here, and making some decisions and choices about, you know, the kind of car we drive, the kind of house we live in, the kind of lifestyle we live, in light of the impact that we have on people in other places.
You've given something away in what you just said, in that you've all the examples you've given are Pacific and regional neighbourhoods close to Australia. That's an area that Australian consciousness is sort of aware of, but it's not front and centre of our political discourse. I guess you coming from New Zealand, that would give you a focus, but it's also something that you feel is significant for Australia.
Australia is in the Pacific's backyard, and it has, in various ways, a big impact on life in Pacific countries. We don't always perceive it that way, but people in the Pacific perceive it that way, particularly when you have a robust economy. It inevitably impacts on neighbourhood. It impacts on neighbourhood in terms of trade, for example. And the government, along with the New Zealand government, have been talking about what kind of trade relationship should there be between the Pacific countries, Australia and New Zealand. But more broadly, you know, I remember being in Vanuatu and the people there talking about how the coastal land was being increasingly bought by Australians, and a lot of the coastal land, in fact the main island of Vanuatu, Afate, is now mainly owned by people who aren't Vanuatu, ni Vanuatu. And they're very conscious of the alienation of their land. So the way we live and how we interact with these Pacific countries, which are more vulnerable in many ways than Australia and New Zealand as larger countries, well, in terms of population generally, you know, that they're very conscious of how close we are and how much of an impact we have on their lives. So we need to be thoughtful about how we engage. And there has been a bit of a tradition sometimes that we're inclined to tell them how they should live their lives. There's been a kind of finger-wagging sometimes approach to relationships. Whereas I think we have an enormous amount to learn from people who have come to live in quite vulnerable contexts and have had to live within the limits of creation. They've had to live within the limits of small islands, very vulnerable to the impact of climate.
I'm going to come back to some particular examples in a few moments' time, but first tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be in such a position and have the interests you have. You grew up in New Zealand.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town in New Zealand with both Māori and Pākehā white ancestry. So my great-great-grandmother came to New Zealand 800 years ago. And my Pākehā great-great-grandfather came to New Zealand in 1830 from Australia. And they met, she became one of his more than one wife. and so I grew up in a small town, I went to university, and it was at university that, as an adult, I decided to become a follower of Jesus Christ. And I joined a church where there was a minister who had travelled quite broadly, and it was a church which received a lot of overseas visitors. So I learned as a law student, I was studying law at the time, about Toyohiko Kagawa, the great Japanese Christian. I learned about Martin Niemöller, the great... They'd all preached at this church. And so automatically, within a few months of having decided to seek to follow Jesus Christ, I learned that I was joining a global family. And I think that has remained with me ever since. Fortunately, in my theological training, I spent some time in Thailand with the theological college there, and then I travelled and saw something of the churches in Eastern Europe, and this was in the having been to Princeton for a year in New Jersey in the United States. So all of these things really deepened my conviction that we are profoundly connected with each other, that that connection is a gift for the world. I remember going from the United States to the Soviet Union, as it then was called, and being at baptisms in both countries within a couple of weeks. And this was at a time when the United States and the Soviet Union were supposedly at war. They, you know, it was mutually assured destruction. They had nuclear weapons pointing at each other. But at a more fundamental and human level, at a really primal level, you might say, we were marking the fact that we were profoundly connected as human beings through the sacrament of baptism. And for me, then, that remains a very important thing. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, has said that this dimension of our humanity is one sign of the presence of God, our ability to rise above our national loyalties, our cultural loyalties, and to actually reach across and to be more than we are simply within our own countries. And I think he's right.
There also seems to be a tradition too, and whether it has something to do with the size of New Zealand or the unitary nature of the state in New Zealand, of churches having a consciousness of their civic engagement and their responsibilities for civic engagement that has played through the life of the church in New Zealand and even extended into Australia. A number of New Zealand church people in all sorts of denominations have found themselves in significant positions in Australian churches over the years.
There's a long history of exchange between Australia and New Zealand. As you think about my own family, you know, my great-great-grandfather came to New Zealand via Australia. And what was reflected in terms of the population. I mean, in 1901, we weren't too far away, were we?
And we were potentially one country.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, and it's not very far away. Like, it's 3 hours' flight, and it's becoming less expensive, and it's much easier than it used to be, although it's if I make a slight pointed remark, it's a little more difficult these days for New Zealanders to live in Australia with all the kind of new regulations that are coming in relation to Australian citizenship, etc. But this is a long history of exchange, and I'm not sure whether it's more now. In fact, I made the point about civil society and civil engagement. One of the things that's impressed me about Australia is the level of church civil engagement compared with New Zealand. The churches are much more evident here than they are in New Zealand. New Zealand is a more secular country than Australia is. And
was that always the case?
I'm not sure. I think there is, because Catholicism, I think, is so strong here in Australia, I think that's probably one of the big elements of it, whereas, relatively speaking, the Catholic Church is smaller in New Zealand. But there seem to be more institutions here. So, you know, you've got Uniting Care, which is the largest non-governmental provider of social services, and you've got the Catholic and Anglican and other similar organ. And in our own area of international mission and development, you know, all of the denominations have very good and robust agencies.
Now, we've probed a little of your New Zealand ancestry. Are there any moments of sort of cultural dissonance when you crossed the ditch?
When I first came here, I realised that Australia and New Zealand were more unlike than I had thought, and particularly in relation to language. Now, everyone could pick up that I wasn't an Australian, but I would often be on the phone listening to people speaking, and I couldn't quite pick up what they were saying. And I remember one particular phone call, I learned that I didn't need to understand the first sentence, or sometimes second, but if I got to the third one, I was in trouble. And there was a particular phone call where a young woman was talking to me from Melbourne, and I got to the third sentence and I had to say, look, I'm terribly sorry. I'm from New Zealand and I haven't exactly picked up what you have to say. And she said, that's what my mother tells me all the time.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guest is the Reverend Dr. Kerry Enright, former head of Uniting World. He just became former yesterday, announcing his retirement from that position because he's going to take up another position at Dunedin in New Zealand, where he's about to become the minister. Now, tell us a little bit about Dunedin and why you're there.
Dunedin is a city of about 120,000 with a university, Great University of Otago. Sadly, it's not very far north of Antarctica, so it has its downside, as Billy Connolly always points out when he visits. But Dunedin is very Scottish. It's the Dunedin, in fact, is the Gaelic for Edinburgh. What attracts me to this congregation particularly is that it's smack up against the University of Otago. And The time at university as a student for me was very influential. It was a time when I changed some of my worldviews. I changed some of the paradigms by which I lived. And so I hope that even in the latter part of my working life, that I will be able to engage with students and talk about these things and engage with them.
Kerry Enright, you've given us a broad general picture. Let's get to some specifics. Over the last 7 or 8 years, one Pacific relationship has particularly troubled Australia, and that's the relationship with Fiji. There was a series of coups, starting with Rambuka almost 20 years ago now, and we're at a point where this year, Julie Bishop, the foreign minister, has announced she'd like to start regularising relationships with Fiji. The Uniting Church and a number of church agencies have actually, behind the scenes, been very important players in facilitating relationships with Fiji. The church is important in Fiji. The Methodist Church is profoundly important in Fiji. And you've had some small part to play in facilitating where this relationship has gone. What's your assessment?
I think that the church's role in Fiji is extremely important, and particularly that of the Methodist Church. The Methodist Church represents something like 75% of the indigenous Fijian, much smaller number of Indo-Fijian. So and it's in every village, so it's extremely influential. The interim Prime Minister, Bainimarama, has highlighted, and I think rightly, that it is unhelpful for a church to become politically partisan. And there are allegations, and I think they're justified, that the Methodist Church had become, seemed to be at least, too partisan towards a particular political party or political group. But the question becomes, what kind of vision do people have for Fiji? Or do they see it as a multi-faith, multi-ethnic, multicultural, diverse society? And is that what they want? Because that's the kind of vision that we had, that evolved for us in discussion with the Methodist Church in Fiji and Rotuma. So we've been working for, particularly since 2009, when the Court of Appeal in Fiji ruled the government was illegal, we've been working particularly with the Methodist Church to enable them to reflect on these issues and think them through. And we've also been encouraging Australia and New Zealand to be more thoughtful and engaging with Fiji rather than just condemnatory. And so the steps that the Australian government and the New Zealand government have taken in response to what the Fiji government has announced in terms of the election date and the steps towards election and the even a flawed constitution, at least they're making steps. The response that Australia and New Zealand have made, I think, is very good. I think that they're being affirming of the steps that Fiji are taking. And in the middle of it remains the Methodist Church, who are now much more clear that they are not going to be aligned with any particular political movement. Their ministers will not be able to serve in Parliament unless they resign. So they're making it very clear that they inhabit a part of civil society, and they're not going to crowd out everybody else.
It's a very interesting observation that Desmond Tutu made at the time that apartheid was being dismantled in South Africa, and so many of Anglican priests and others had been identified with the ANC and others during the years of struggle. He basically ordered them to disengage. And when asked why, he said the role of the church in a new democratic society is one of critical collaboration.
Yeah.
That is, you must stand apart from the government. We are now in a different world, a different frame.
Yeah.
It's a very sophisticated idea for people to grasp.
Yes, I've just been listening to Miroslav Volf, who's been visiting Australia and who was on the ABC Q&A program. And he talks about a plural political culture, so that it is proper for religions to make truth claims. That's what we do. We make claims for special insight, so to speak. But we do it in a pluralistic society, in a politically pluralistic society. That society, that democracy, calls on us to articulate as clearly and thoughtfully as we can the values that we hold dear and the particular vision that we uphold. As Christians, we do it alongside people who are Muslim, alongside people who are Buddhist, alongside people who are, you know, all of the faiths, all seeking to do the same and all encouraged to do the same. And democracy itself requires us to do that in order for it to be healthy. So for people who have a secular worldview, they must do the same. And I think this helps us in places like Fiji and across the Pacific. Across the Pacific, generally, the relationship between the church and the state is much closer and more porous than it is in classically Western society.
And there's a tendency for some of those in the church to wish to absolutize their values, to say this must be imposed on all for the good of all because it is the truth.
Yes, there were people in Fiji who did that at a particular time. Not the Methodist Church, they would say they didn't themselves do that, but there were people in leadership or in positions of influence who, particularly in 1987, sought to do that. Civil society is... I think that the challenge for the church is to recognise that it has a place. Its position is well articulated, perhaps more from the margins than from the centre sometimes.
Fiji now stands on the brink of some progress. There are elections coming up.
Yeah.
Some say, look, this could tip us back 30 years because what you have in Fiji now is still a pretty profound divide. culturally, Bainimarama and his people represent the outsiders from the old Fiji establishment, the chiefly society, and that those who support the old chiefly system are still there and will take the opportunity of the elections to basically come back in and reinstitute that old Fiji system, which will lead to all the problems.
Well, that's why other parts of civil society in this context have a really important role to articulate and to uphold a different kind of vision from what used to be the pervasive vision. I think that's what I'm saying, that in many ways I think there's a similarity between the Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa and apartheid, and the Methodist Church in Fiji, and the multicultural, multi-faith future of Fiji. I think that both churches have a significant role to articulate deeper values, which inform how people express their political commitments, but don't determine them, so to speak. You know what I mean? They don't say what this is the way you must vote. You must vote for SDL or Labour or whatever. But they articulate deeper values and a bigger vision. Fiji, in order for Fiji to flourish, that's what it requires. And I think my sense is that actually the interim Prime Minister recognises that. I think that's part of why he's entered into the democratic process. And I think he's also said that he's done as much as he can. Now it is up to the church and to the chiefs. And you're right. I mean, that is where power lies, not just in the democratic process.
It'll be interesting to see the way that progresses forward and the role that the church plays in that. Just before we leave this entirely, you've spoken about the way the church has been able to influence things in Fiji, but you've had training as a lawyer, and in part of this scenario as it's unfolded, there are moments when, as somebody who's experienced and has an interest in constitutions and law and other things, you must have been able to play the game back the other way, or been called upon to play the game back the other way, to take messages to the Australian government and say, look, not sure about this.
We've sought to influence the various people and groups engaging with Fiji in all the ways that a church does. You know, you do it in a formal way by writing letters and having meetings, but you do it also informally as well. Just like any other person or group seeks to influence people in light of the particular values and vision that you have, so we have done that. That's just part of how we go about things, just how the church and its organisations go about things. We're not trying to be, we're not trying to lobby or be precious or claim any special position, but you're trying to articulate, you know, what you believe and hold true.
Let me use an example that's not in your immediate bailiwick, but you'd have an interest in, and that's East Timor. Yeah. We've seen the way, it's the old adage spelt out, you know, there are only national interests when it comes to global politics, and the debate over the East Timorese and the disposition of the oil fields and the border. Now, is there a role for the churches there in saying to government, hang on, there are principles you should observe? Because you have people on both sides of that divide. The church is, in that sense, a global institution. National governments, sovereign governments have their own interests.
National interest doesn't mean that the government or a nation has to be aggressive and claim more than what it is due to have, what it rightfully has. Woodrow Wilson was one of the first internationalist presidents of the United States, leading in World War One and then in the League of Nations. And he made the point, as a president of the United States, that if we were going to become involved as nations in international politics, we needed to be thoughtful about how far we stretched, how far we reached, and we didn't go beyond what was properly ours. He was making it in the context, of course, where people wanted to punish Germany for World War One. And he said, if we keep overreaching ourselves, there will be a consequence. There will be another war. People did not listen to him. There was another war. So nations need to have a degree of humility and not just be demanding and aggressive and only think in a very narrow way, because there are always consequences to that. There are political and economic and social consequences for that. There must be some kind of national humility.
Our guest on Sunday night, the Reverend Dr. Kerry Enright of Uniting World, the Uniting Church's Agency for International Church Partnerships. Kerry Enright, we're rapidly running out of time. It's been fascinating to spend these few minutes with you, but we're going to ask you a couple of questions before you go. You're taking up a new position in Dunedin. You've outlined it for us. What do you see your role now as to be? Just a local church pastor? And if so, what is it for you is the most essential thing about the Christian witness, the Christian message? The importance of the... What's the critical importance of the faith for you?
When I was a lawyer, I used to appear nearly every day in court, in a court, a magistrate's court, district court now, in Auckland. And every Wednesday I appeared in the Children and Young Persons Court and I would act for young people and I would try and keep them out of prison. That was what I was trying to do. Week by week I would appear, I'd appear for one sibling, this was frequently the story. Then a few months later I'd appear for another sibling and then a few months later I'd appear for another sibling. And this began to eat away at me, that I... These people, if you have three siblings you're acting for, they're not there by choice in a way. They're there by dint of the circumstances that led them to act in the way they did. And at the same time in the church I had come to understand more about what love was about, what acceptance was about, what empowerment was about, because that's what I was experiencing. And there was this juxtaposition between the predicament of young people who I was desperately trying to keep out of prison, and my own situation. And I wanted to be part of a movement that saw a more just, more accepting, more loving, and more inclusive society. And that's why I became a minister, because you can't do that on your own. You must do it as part of... You can only do it as part of a movement in collaboration with others. And that experience... 30-something years ago, 35 years ago, remains with me the fire in my belly. And it remains, it holds out for me a vision of New Zealand and of Dunedin and of the community of Dunedin, so we don't have to build more prisons.
Is that for you the essence of what evangelism is? That is, evangelism is not finger-wagging, moralising, sermonising. That the effective evangelism, particularly in the light of things like the scandals over sex abuse and other things, has to be seen in an utterly different way?
For me, there are kind of two dimensions to evangelism. One is what I was saying before about our role in civil society, of being able to articulate what it is we hold dear, the vision and the values. So that is partly evangelism, articulating that into the public space. The other aspect of it is enlisting people for that vision, whether they're card-carrying Christians signed up to follow Jesus or not. I want to collaborate with people of goodwill. Now, on the way, I'd like them to have a sense that what is driving me and others is this figure, this message, this Jesus message. It may not happen, but it often happens. Now, I don't know what comes of that. I don't know what necessarily comes of that.
It's a process of osmosis.
Yes, it may well be. I think that's how it happened for me. I soaked it. Yes, it is a process of osmosis. We soak it in from other people. The most important thing is, what is the society that we are aiming for? What is the vision that we hold out there? And how can we work collaboratively to get it so we don't have more prisons, so we don't have more young people going to prison?
Kerry Enright, it's been great to have you with us. The critical question is football. Wallabies?
Well, I assume by football you mean really rugby.
Yeah, I do.
Yes. Well, of course, being an ecumenical person, I will barrack for both teams, although as one president of the Uniting Church put it, I think your heart might be black.
As Kerry Enright, thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you, John. Thanks very much.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.